Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
We are joined again this morning by Dr. Donald Stern, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District. Good morning, Dr. Stern. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Ted. It's my pleasure.
Always good to have you in and talk about all of this. As we look at the numbers each day, and you kind of track things, as you look at the numbers in the local health district, anything that you've seen this week that kind of jumps out at you?
Well, you know, Ted, I believe that we're not out of the woods yet, but I think I can see the peak of the mountain and maybe even a little bit of blue sky on the other side.
Wow, that is good to hear.
As I look at the data, okay, this started in March, and as I look at continue to track the data and plot this data out for our locality, it's the number of new cases and the number of new hospitalizations has plateaued off over the last week. Now, we had, I think, an artifact yesterday with 26 new cases yesterday, but that looks like, I think, a reporting artifact, a function of our electronic information system that was down for a day. And so I'm thinking some cases got counted yesterday that may have been in the prior day. But, you know, when this started in March, when COVID-19 pandemic hit our community in March, we were initially getting one or two cases a day. Then a week later, it was up to 5 to 8 cases a day. And then a week later, it was 10 to 15 cases a day. Over the last week, it's been about 17 to 20 cases a day. Except for the artifact yesterday. And that's been pretty consistent in terms of new hospitalizations, which is a pretty good index for because people who are really severely impacted by this disease are going to end up in the hospital. So those started out, you know, one a day every other day, and then that increased within a week to two hospitalizations a day. A week later, it was 3 to 5 hospitalizations a day. But over the last week, it's been one hospitalization a day. In fact, yesterday, we had no new hospitalizations reported. And note, too, that most of those people who have been hospitalized are coming out and going home and returning to at least what the normal life is as we know it today, which is not so normal.
Right.
But most folks who have had this disease, that is, that we know of, who've had a positive COVID-19 test, are not going to the hospital, are not isolated in the hospital. They're isolated at home. Most of the that's true for more than half of the cases. So I think we're faring this disease well. I feel compassion for those families who've lost family members because of this. But, you know, most of those have been folks who had underlying chronic illnesses. So it's interesting. I'm getting this kind of pushback or question. Why are we claiming every death is a COVID-19 death when people have other kinds of diseases that are really causing their death? Folks need to understand that it's the medical provider that fills out the death certificate. The health department doesn't make that decision. The hospital administration doesn't make that decision. The medical provider makes that decision. So when on the bottom of the death certificate where the provider signs, they have to declare what the cause of death was. Hmm. Well, you can imagine somebody who has hypertension, congestive heart failure, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, for example, or maybe diabetes, and then gets COVID-19 and passes. What does the physician write on that in that primary cause of death, secondary cause of death, and contributing factors. Well, COVID-19 needs to be on that list somewhere.
Yeah.
So as we record and get the official counts of death due to this, COVID-19 ought to be in there somewhere if that contributed to this person's death, whether it's the listed as the primary cause of death or the secondary or contributing factor.
Boy, just the fact, though, that you said a couple of minutes ago that you're starting to see the mountains and maybe a little bit of blue sky. That is good news, because really for the last 6 weeks or so, this has been we've been all trying to focus on and doing what we can as far as staying in and washing our hands and all of that. And to hear you say that is really good news and really good to hear this morning.
Sure, Ted. And this doesn't mean we can all just relax back, go out and do whatever we want. And we still need to employ those good hygiene measures, washing our hands, using hand sanitizer, practicing social distancing, wearing the mask when you go out in public. But we are cautiously optimistic that we actually may be seeing the crest of the mountain on this, that we may... because, as I've said, looking at the data, it looks like it's plateaued off now.
And a lot of the data did talk that late April we would see this. So that data has proven to be true.
Yes.
Dr. Donald Stern here, the acting director of the Rappahannock Area Health District. Much to talk about this morning. We're going to take a quick break and come back and get back with it with Dr. Stern when we come back on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. You can weigh in about today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Donald Stern here this morning, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District. So, Dr. Stern, understanding, and just so people understand, you're not the one who makes this call, but as you talk about, the number of new cases and new hospitalizations falling, are those some of the things that the decision makers, and in this case, the governor, will decide when, as they look at things about when to slowly reopen?
Yes, sir. They're very data-driven in their decision-making, though some would suggest this is, politics, in a big way, so and so forth. And some of the banter you may hear, between, the federal level and governors across the country, there's some politics certainly in that. But we're dealing with a nationwide pandemic, worldwide pandemic, and so there's a lot of science trying to be incorporated here to make these very, very difficult decisions. And yes, I'll assure you that the governor and his staff, the state health commissioner, are looking very carefully at the number of new cases, the number of hospitalizations, the number of need for ventilatory assistance in the hospital, because the reason why these extreme measures were put into place was not just to control for spread of disease, but we have classic public health strategies for preventing spread of disease in communities. But because this disease was so infectious and everybody in the community was susceptible, no one has ever seen this virus before. So everybody's susceptible. There was a concern that our hospital systems would be overwhelmed. We saw that in Italy. New York got hit real bad. So there was an intent nationwide and led by not only the feds but governors to prevent that from happening, because once you overwhelm your medical care system, then what do those people do? So this effort was to try to not only prevent the spread of disease but to preserve life as well. Some would argue that the current state, why have we put in these extreme measures? It's not as bad as first predicted. We're not seeing as many deaths, and if you remember the early models, we're talking about 1 to 2 million deaths in the United States. Well, that was, those models were based on no interventions put in place. We have, I think the reason why we see the lower numbers, the lower number of deaths, and this now plateauing off is because of the interventions we have put into place. So we've got to be careful about backing off on those too quickly, because what will happen, I'll guarantee you, we'll have more people interacting with people. Those with disease will transmit this COVID-19 to others, and we'll see an uptake in disease. So we kind of have to back off slowly. But I see a return to normal life over a period of time. Probably, though, you know, this, again, like you suggested, is the governor's call. But it will be data-driven, and it is based on number of new cases and hospitalizations.
Well, you, and like you say, in the early days of this, and I remember you, the local hospital officials being really concerned that the fact that the numbers have been so low really it's, I mean that's another really good news measure of this. A lot of people have done what they need to do, and like we've said, the numbers have been very manageable in this area.
A good point, Ted. You remind me that it's not government policy necessarily. It's that people have complied and people are participating, and they keep in mind other people's interest and needs first, because for most folks, younger folks in particular, and those who have no underlying medical disease, they handle this fairly well. Though those who are elderly and with underlying medical conditions may suffer severe illness. It's good to keep in mind that this isn't just about me. It's about others and protecting others from contracting this disease.
And that's where you right from the get go, when a few weeks ago when you suggested we all start wearing masks, you talked about that fact. Wear it for the other person. So you're doing it to protect them.
Well, that's true, and the data shows that out. I mean, even before we had COVID-19, it was clear that masks are not effective for protecting you yourself against upper respiratory infections. But for the person who's infected, it helps keep them from spreading the disease to others. So because this disease can be asymptomatic and or a mild disease, you may not even know you have it and could be spreading it to others. So it's good for folks in public, especially if they're around groups, to be putting on those masks.
Boy, and that remains to me one of the real terrors kind of this whole thing, the asymptomatic part of it, that you can have it and not know it. And that does remain one of the things about this whole thing, that it's kind of fascinating to see that, you know, that whole end of it.
Correct. Yeah. So, and that's why for us, from a public health point of view, is we try to do our case contact workup. Remember, for every positive case, those are required to be reported to the local health department. So what? What do we do with that? Every one of those positive cases, those individuals then are contacted by the health department, and we do an extensive interview with these folks to try to determine who the contacts are that otherwise may be at risk for transmission of disease. We also give guidance regarding the necessity for isolation or quarantine. But after that initial interview, then we may interview the supervisor, other folks, to try to determine who in the workplace or who at home may be at risk for disease. And then we contact all those contacts and advise them, give them guidance regarding the necessity for quarantine. This is a huge amount of work. I probably have 15 staff of my staff working on that every day. You know, when you get 20 new cases a day and you have to make all those phone calls and give guidance and advice and answer questions and then contact all their contacts, It's a huge amount of work with over 300 cases now in our community and 1,000 of contacts now. It's been quite demanding work, but our staff are hanging in there. They're doing good work. I have several people working over 70 hours a week right now, and that's just because, well, there's a certain demand for this work to be done. And we're also in a state hiring freeze, which is curious, but it's difficult when you try to continue to provide for the community some of the core public health services on top of a pandemic with the hiring freeze on at the same time.
Yeah. I never put those two together. And I would think that as things start as things get eased up, you'd think it's just natural that some of these numbers are going to go up a little bit when there is some of the easing. And I would think you're going to need more people as time goes on, as long as you're doing the contacts.
Oh yeah. For us, this is work ongoing, because even as we start backing off, as the governor starts backing off on the public policies to restrict or to prevent spread of disease, we're still going to have disease, and we're still going to do case contact workup. We're still going to do that infection control, those infection control measures that we classically do for infection control. I mean, folks may not know it, but we're doing this all the time. For example, somebody with the tuberculosis, it's the same thing we do for TB. We interview that case, find out who the contacts are, interview the contacts, isolate and quarantine those folks. Whether somebody has gonorrhea or syphilis or measles or chickenpox or whatever, there's a list of over 60 diseases which are codified as reportable, what are called reportable diseases, that physicians and laboratories are required to report to the local health department. And we track folks down, and we isolate, quarantine, provide guidance and advice to prevent spread of disease in the community. And this is a major challenge for us with COVID-19, but our staff are doing a wonderful job with this. I think they're part of the what I call hidden heroes in regards to pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic. In addition to that, we have a call center. I gave you the number last time we talked. We've got staff who are on that phone 24 hours a day. We're getting about 30 calls a day right now. It was running about 50 to 60 calls a day. People who are worried, people with questions, providers who want to know how to get testing for their patients. These are skilled nursing staff primarily who are on our call center. And some Medical Reserve Corps volunteers are helping out. It's been a great augmentation of our staff to have the Medical Reserve Corps volunteers.
That number you mentioned is 540-899-4797. Again, it's from 8 to 4:30, 899-4797 is that information number. And it's interesting you said that about the heroes, because I was going to make that point to you today, that I've seen so many people talk about all the other heroes in the community. And to me, the health department, and you besides just providing numbers and a lot of times breaking down those numbers, you've put out some charts this week on different things, and the contact testing, and there just so much goes on with the health department. And a lot of people today, because I know a number of people in the health department, and over the past year, this show has we focused in on a lot of the different things that the health department does. And I've really only gotten through about half of what goes on there. A lot of us don't understand just the day-to-day things that go on, and something like this happens, and I would think a lot of people are doing some things and involved in things that normally day-to-day they're not involved in, but because the need is there, they've switched hats.
That's correct. About 50% of my entire staff are directly involved in working COVID-19. So in addition to just those kind of communicable disease measures we're putting into place around COVID-19, we're trying to be prospective as well. So we have developed a long-term healthcare center or facility plan, providing support and backup for long-term care centers. You know what's happened in Henrico County, the one facility now that's had over 40 deaths. We don't want that to happen in our community. So a couple of weeks back, we began contacting all the long-term care centers in Planning District 16, which numbers 21. We asked them to complete a risk assessment, which was initially offered by the state as a volunteer risk assessment for their self-completion and learning. But we've used that tool now and asked them, and for some of them, actually walked through that risk assessment to determine their readiness in case they have a case or an outbreak in their facility. We provided fit testing or training, the trainer fit testing 2 weeks ago now for all the long-term care facilities. 20 of the 21 were represented in that training. And then we gave them what stock we had in personal protective equipment, masks and gowns and the such. In addition to that, we've now developed the capacity to provide testing support. In fact, the one facility that right now has a COVID-19 case in the long-term care center called us first. This is exactly how it should work. They called us, and we have a few patients with elevated temperature. We provided testing support for them. Most of those came back negative, but one patient came back on the second test positive for COVID-19. And this long-term care center has done everything right. They've isolated that individual. They've trained their staff. They're checking their staff every morning as they walk in the door, properly putting on their personal protective equipment, employing the other infection control measures in their facility to prevent the spread. We've not had any spread in this facility. So in addition to providing that kind of initial assessment of risk, testing support, we're also providing ongoing advice and guidance to these facilities and willing to even go in if we have to. But, of course, one of our axioms with long-term care centers is trying to minimize the number of people going in and out. And you can't always do that when you have, for example, a resident that needs to go to the hospital and then come back. Some providers, home health or hospice care providers coming in and out. But we're trying to provide those kind of infection control guidance for our long-term care centers. And they are very interested. No one wants an outbreak in a long-term care center. But I'll tell you, Ted, in addition to that, we're trying to think prospectively. What if one of our long-term care centers gets into trouble? What if there's a lack of leadership, a lack of corporate office support for that long-term care center? What if, for example, happens with one of our long-term care centers, like what we've seen in the media elsewhere in the country, mm-hmm. where staff just don't show up? You get a case, staff become fearful, and they don't show up. What do you do then? So we've developed what we call a strike team, working in partnership with Mary Washington Healthcare to develop a strike team that can go in and not only provide laboratory support and advice, but also then do patient triage, determine what medical support those patients need in the long-term care center, decide on which ones need to be isolated, and maybe which ones need to be transported. In the extreme case that we saw in the media, a week or two ago with a nursing home where the staff didn't show up, they ended up having to transport all those folks out. We need to be prepared. I hope we'd never need to evoke the strike team, but we've got a great group of folks at Mary Washington Hospital, Mary Washington Healthcare, and our staff to develop this team of folks who could assist a long-term care center immediately in the event of an outbreak that seems to be getting out of control.
Yeah, yeah, great planning and a great illustration of and what is going on between your office and the healthcare community in the region. Dr. Donald Stern here, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District. We need to take a break, and we will continue on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It's 8:33.
Okay, listen, we got to talk about something.
Talk done right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. Opinions, we've all got them, and we'd like to hear yours on Town Talk. Brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Donald Stern in this morning, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District. Dr. Stern, as we talked about in the last segment, about what you're doing with senior citizen centers, I guess jails are another concern because we've started to see some reports in the correctional system of cases.
Yes, you may have seen a report on the, I think it's called Deerfield Correctional Institution in the Freelance Star this morning. yeah, this is, you know, when you put a bunch of folks in congregate living, so to speak, if you wanted to call a jail that, sure, it's a place of concern, and this virus can spread through a correctional facility fairly quickly. And this is classically known. You know, there's lots of research and papers on TB, for example, in correctional facilities, and how flu can spread through a correctional facility. So it's reasonable for us to pay special attention to that because these are places that COVID-19 can spread through quickly. So similar to what we've done with the long-term care centers, we've initiated efforts to contact all of our jails, correctional institutions, and ICE facility in Caroline County to make sure that they're aware of the CDC and VDH guidelines, that they've done a risk assessment to determine their infection control practices and have proper PPE, for example, personal protective equipment, and that we're communicating that if something's going on, that we know what's going on and we can help advise and support those facilities. We've not talked about doing any kind of a strike team for a correctional facility. That becomes much more complex with a correctional facility, but we are supporting our local jails, our correctional facilities in these regards.
The homeless, is that another area that you're keeping your eye on?
Good question, because what happens to a homeless person if they get COVID-19?
Right.
You know, these are folks that sometimes struggle with just getting their act together on a day-to-day basis or struggling. If they end up in the hospital, then where do they go? So I actually received a call a couple of weeks ago from Xavier Richardson, I believe senior vice president and president of the foundation, inquiring about, is there something we could work on together in these regards? Is, yes, sir. Sure is. So we talked about the value of discharge planning for folks who are homeless or even folks who are under-resourced. You know, some folks can't pay their rent, so on and so forth, are really struggling these days. So the question was, from a public health point of view, of course, is how do we help make sure that person is protected and that others are safe from transmission of disease? But then there's a whole broader social issue around homeless or people who are under-resourced. So we contacted the George Washington Regional Commission. They have an interest in this and have traditionally worked together with homeless shelters in the community and began an ad hoc task group to talk about and work out a strategy for how to manage those folks who are coming out of the hospital to make sure they have not only a safe place in preventing the spread of disease, that have shelter, food, and other necessities in order to protect them and in order to protect the classic shelter community, because you may not want somebody who's COVID-19 positive and still infectious coming into your shelter.
No.
So they've worked out those plans. We should be pretty close to implementing that strategy so that we're actually doing discharge planning. The hospital would be notifying us and then the working with the shelter community in these regards.
What's exciting about this is you know, as we've talked about senior centers or jails or the homeless, you really are, you're not just reacting to this. You're very proactive in the health department and then working with the various agencies around here to try to prevent this as much as we can.
Yes, sir. There's one other group I should mention. You know, we have a sizable non-documented, non-citizen Hispanic population in our community that works in many of our industries and agriculture, construction, lawn care industry. You know, it's a big deal in California. We're wondering about whether this is an issue that we ought to be paying attention to, because a lot of these folks live in very close quarters and with lots of people in the household. What a great way to spread disease.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to figure out ways in which we might reach these communities that frequently don't want to talk to government folks, you know,
right,
who and may not have any English skills. So how do we reach that community with guidance for preventing a spread of disease? Because, you know, it's to all of our benefit. If one of these folks gets sick, and at the severe level, they're going to end up in our hospital. So it's reasonable for us to employ prevention strategies to help the spread of disease, not only within their community, but throughout the entire community. It's watching out for the other person.
That brings up a question about if I were to be diagnosed and then I quarantine at home, do I stay in one room and I would just use a bathroom exclusively for me and just stay away from everyone in my home?
Yes, sir. That would be our guidance, is to try to isolate if somebody's COVID-19 positive.
Yeah.
Our guidance, our staff will talk to them about what measures they could take to best isolate themselves in their home. There's a great story in this morning's Freelance Star webpage about one county board of supervisor in Stafford County, mm-hmm, who had COVID-19 and had to self-isolate. It's a dramatic story about how severe, not only how severe the illness is, but the stress of that isolation status. Yeah, it's important to do that so that you don't spread the disease to others. So if there's a way to stay in your room, to keep to not share bathroom facilities or any other, you know, like cooking and food. And so frequently what happens is, the way we advise folks is that other household members prepare food and bring that to the room of the person in isolation, rather than that person in isolation coming out and going and using the kitchen or bathroom facilities or whatever. It's, you know, it's employing what I term reasonable practicality in order to prevent the spread of disease. And if people understand how this disease is spread, they can make their own conscious decisions. People don't need necessarily government to tell them what to do. If people just think smart and practical, they can successfully self-isolate, self-quarantine, and prevent the spread of this disease.
Because as you have said to me multiple times, over and over and over again, this is spread person to person. That's how it spreads.
Well, and on contact surfaces as well. That's pretty clear that, you know, the infected person gets the virus on their hand, touches the doorknob, for example, and the next person comes along and opens the door, and they've got the virus now in their hand. If they're touching their face, mouth, nose, they may then contract the disease that way.
Dr. Donald Stern here this morning, the acting director of the Rappahannock Area Health District. Have you noticed just it seems that we've gone as a society from just total anxiety about this to now you're starting to just to see some anger and wanting to open things up and get back. It seems that we're starting to see that more and more in society.
Yeah, I think you're right, Ted. I mean, it's not just flag-waving folks driving around the Capitol who are angry. There's a substantial amount of that throughout our community because people want to go back to work. They want to go back to normal life. I've had people argue with me that, when are you going to tell us what the next stage is on this and when can we start doing? It's not my call. You know, my responsibility and the responsibility of your local health department is to employ strategies to prevent the spread of disease. When we open up our economy, put businesses, let businesses go back to work, that's the governor's call. And you can see there's a lot of that in the TV media and other media right now. And this is all causing, people are really stressed out now. And I think, you know, as we talk about the impact of COVID-19, we count the number of disease and count the number of hospitalizations and count the number of deaths. But I think there's going to be a substantial amount of economic impact as we see businesses not able to reopen, as we see the stress of this from a mental health point of view on individuals in our community, the fear and the anxiety and now growing anger in our community. And I otherwise don't have a solution for that other than encourage people that we're about to the top of the mountain. I think I can see some blue on the other side. We will get through this. This will pass. This is a classic infectious disease incident. The only difference is it's a new virus that everybody is susceptible. We knew a lot of people were going to get sick. Therefore, we had to have, the governor chose to put in some substantial measures to prevent the spread of disease so we don't overwhelm our hospitals. And that's been a successful measure. Do you know of any hospital in Virginia that's been overwhelmed by COVID-19? No. We didn't want, you know, we've seen some of that in New York, certainly in Italy. Italy was overwhelmed very quickly, very early. But I think we've been successful at these measures, and it's, we're getting close, I think, to starting to back off, and you're hearing that, I think, from the governor's office now. There is a timetable for that and some serious conversations going on. So we're about to the top of the mountain here. I think we can see some blue on the other side.
I just want to hear you say that over and over again. I'm going to make that my ringtone this weekend just to hear that because it just makes me so happy. Dr. Donald Stern here, the acting director of the Rappahannock Area Health District. We need to take a quick break and we will conclude when we come back on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. Got a question for today's guest? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Donald Stern, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District, is in this morning. The cough and the fever are your classic kind of situations where you ought to seek medical attention if it starts to, especially if your fever starts going up.
Yes. Let me clarify that a bit. That would be true, especially for elderly and folks with underlying medical disease. They should be more cautious and should be more sensitive to their fever or any symptoms, and should be contacting their primary care provider in this case. For most folks, otherwise, a little fever, a cough, they can self-isolate. Probably ought to talk to their primary care provider, but they could still self-isolate. They don't necessarily need to be tested either. Our testing capability has improved over the last couple of weeks, but we still don't want to overwhelm the labs with lots of testing that will slow down the turnaround time on these labs and make it difficult for those that really need the diagnostic workup. But Ted, I did want to mention before we end here, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't say what people can do to protect themselves and to protect others. People have heard this over and over and over again, but the best thing you could do for yourself and do for others is to practice those infection control measures we've been talking about for some time. Stay home as much as possible, especially if you're ill, and especially if you have an upper respiratory infection. This is to protect others from spread of disease, whether it's the flu or the cold or COVID-19. When you go out into public for an essential task, such as grocery shopping, or folks still are working, those essential employees, practice the social distancing 6 feet away, and wear your cloth mask if you're around groups of people. Now, you don't have to wear a cloth mask if you're, you know, out in public, but like day before yesterday, I went for a run, and I don't wear a mask when I go for a run, and I even came across one of my neighbors who was going for a walk and stopped for a while, and we chatted, but we kept our distance. Neither of us had a mask on, and that's okay. Then I completed my run. But if you're around groups of people, it's important to wear that mask. Again, it's essential not to go out if you're sick. Maintain good hygiene, hand washing, and hand sanitizers work very well, simple and easy to use, so hand washing and frequent use of hand sanitizers. And then cleaning of contact surfaces. We talked about the doorknob scenario. Now, we don't do that in our home. I don't clean contact surfaces every day, all day long, because I don't have people coming in and out of the house with, you know, who may be COVID-19 positive. But if there's lots of movement in and out, particularly in maybe in the workplace or other places where people are moving in and out, it's reasonable to clean.
Dr. Donald Stern, the acting director of the Rappahannock Area Health District. Dr. Stern, looking forward to talking to you again. Thank you so much, and thank you for what you all are doing.
Providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own, and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.